Hello everyone, my name is Magdalena and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to thank Bill for asking me to speak and Mary Emma for giving up my name. It's always such a great honor when alcoholics contact the Al-Anons. It's like they still want us around. I was grateful. Thanks, Carol, for picking me up from the airport. She was chasing an alcoholic. She was chasing a drunk driver, but she didn't try to stop him. She called the police to assist. So we're trying, you know, getting better one day at a time. And Janet, thanks so much for everything, for contacting me. And it's such a great honor to meet another Al-Anon friend and seeing all my old friends, Doug, Carla, Bill, Matthew, new friend, and Terry. It's always fun to see Terry. So thanks, everybody. Okay. My home group is the Renton Thursday night. It's about 20 miles south of Seattle. It's the oldest group in the state of Washington. And my home group is one of those groups that they try to register with Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill said, you know, they said, the alcoholics said, well, you guys need to form your own thing. You know, we don't want to register families of alcoholics. So what Bill said to Lois, his wife, he said, why don't you start an Al-Anon family group? And Lois said, Bill, I'm on my 60s. I've been homeless for a long time. I like to work on my garden. But thank God that Lois had the love for the friends and families of alcoholics. Because of her, I am here today, and many of us are. So when Lois and her friend Anne, who was her neighbor, decided to get together and write letters to many groups. I believe it was 86 groups that were registered with Alcoholics Anonymous. They wrote letters asking, would you like to be a part of a family group? And 51 groups responded, and my home group is one of those who responded. So we will be 65 years in June. So anyways, that's my home group. So what it was like, what happened, and how it is today. I am from Ensenada, Mexico. My father is the first alcoholic that I met. He was my parents met when they were about 15, 16 years old. My mom got pregnant, and I am the first child of five daughters. Well, she has six daughters, but I am the first. My dad always wanted a boy, and I was born. He named me after his father. His name was Magdaleno, so they just changed the O to an A. And like I said, my father always wanted a boy, and he and I have, you know, we never had a relationship. I have always had a big mouth. I like to fight. You know, when you tell me something and I don't think it's fair, I talk back to you, you know. So anyways, my mom was, you know, she was, like I said, very young, and she was, I think she had a sixth grade education, and so my father was a baker, or he's still alive. And so I was, I always ask my mom, why is it that you guys never talk about my grandfather? I was named after him. I like to know a little more about him. And she said, well, nobody talks about him because he was crazy. And I said, well, what's wrong with him? And she said, well, he drank too much. You know, so the story goes that what they did with my grandfather on those old days in Mexico, they built a box in the backyard and they stuck my grandfather in there, you know. And because he was crazy, they just opened a little door like that, you know, and they fed him through the little door. And that was the cure for alcoholism in Mexico back in the... So the only friend that my father had was my father. So my father started drinking with his father when he was about 8 years old. So by the time they met, my father was already a problem drinker. My father is this kind of alcoholic that always had a lady on the side. You know, he was a macho man, and so he kept always having somebody on the side, and my mom kept having kids, and I just couldn't understand why. You know, my dad is about 5'5", 5'4", 5'5", big belly, big head, really ugly. You know? And my mom is tall. I think my mom's gorgeous. You know, she's light complexion. And she's just beautiful. And I just couldn't understand why she was staying with this guy, you know. We lived in this tiny little house with two rooms. And when it rained in the house as well. We had dirt floor, and my dad would tell me every morning, you know, I have always been tall and thin, and so he would tell me, Larguchona, which means really nothing, is something ugly and long. So, Larguchona, get up and sweep the floor. And I remember looking at my dad and saying, why, it's a dirt floor. You know, it didn't make sense to me, but it did to him. So anyways, my dad didn't like my answers, and he would pull out this skinny little leather belt that he had for years and years, and he would just pull it out and hit me, you know, just hit me. All his anger would go into my skinny arms and legs, and he would also tell me, Larguchona, get up and go get me a bottle of tequila. And when you're a kid in Mexico, they sell alcohol to the kids. So I would go to that liquor store, get him this big bottle of tequila. And I remember walking back with this tequila and thinking, my gosh, I can't remember the last time I had milk. All we eat at home is beans and tortillas. There's nothing else. And so when I would get home, I will give him the bottle of tequila and let him know that I had not had milk in a long time. You know, my dad's a baker. We didn't even have bread in the house. So my dad had a problem with me telling him about his drinking. And so he will pull the skinny belt and just hit me with it. And then I will go to school like that. And I remember, you know, in Mexico, most of the kids are short and chubby. You know, they're cute. And I'm tall and skinny. I just look different, and I just couldn't mix very well. And the kids would say, gosh, you know, how's the weather up there? And they will also say, we don't want to play with you. You look weird. And look at you. Your dad beat you up again. And the kids would say, and then you smell like beans. And I did, because we didn't even have a toothbrush. So anyways, I felt rejected at school. I didn't feel loved at home. And I got really involved in yoga. I started doing yoga when I was 6 years old. I was this wonderful kid that got up in front of a group and taught adults yoga. And my dad thought that was witchcraft. So, I had to hide from him. And in school, I didn't do well. I stayed back in third grade 3 times because I could not understand. You know when you're a kid and you're in school, and I remember looking at the letters, looking at the book, and trying to read, but the words would just dance. You know, I just could not learn. I just could not read. And while I was trying to read, I'll be thinking, am I going to eat tonight? Is my dad going to beat me up? Do I need to go gather wood so my mom can cook? Most of the time we had no electricity, no running water. And so it was just a mess. So I stayed back in third grade 3 times. And I was this tall, skinny, stupid looking kid. And my dad told me every day, you should not go to school. Women should be selling food on the streets. And so that was his way of thinking. My dad is this kind of alcoholic that will come home and vomit all over, and I just did not like alcohol. And my mom, like I said, she just kept having kids, and I couldn't understand it. But she said back in those days, if a person took the pill, the Pope had told them that they would go to hell. Okay, so she didn't want to go to hell. She just kept having kids. But what my mom didn't know is that living with my alcoholic father, who was so ugly, was already hell enough, you know, but she just didn't get it. So, when I started dating, I didn't want anything to do with alcoholics. Going back a little bit, thinking, you know, that my dad was a bad guy. I always thought my dad was a bad guy. I didn't know that my dad was sick. You know, my dad's still drinking until this day. I think he's 79 years old, and he's one of those guys that never got it. And I don't believe that in his right mind, my dad would have hit an innocent child, because, you know, we love our kids, and so, but his alcoholism was out of control. And so, doing an inventory in Al-Anon, I learned that not everything that I went through as a child was a bad thing. I had these wonderful grandparents. Oh, my maternal grandparents just loved me. Every time they saw me, they told me I was their favorite grandchild. And they called me Negra, which is my black girl, because I was the darkest. But you know what happens in Washington? Because we have no light, we get lighter. I get lighter, the miracle happened. I changed colors. So anyways, And my grandma, I would go and spend a lot of time with my grandparents, and my grandmother would make flour tortillas, and we would sing lullabies, and then she would give me a tortilla, and I would put butter on it, and I would eat it, and go next room where my grandfather was. And I just thought my grandfather was so smart. He was so smart. He always read old books, and I smelled the books, and they just smelled so good, And then I would sit on my grandfather's laps, and he would read to me. And then also when I was sitting on my grandfather's laps, I was helping him clean the seats out of the marijuana. And then I would help him. I would roll the joints for him, you know. And then my grandfather would take a, you know, would start smoking his pot. And he would say, "Hey, mija, you want to have a hit?" And I would say, "Oh, no, Grandpa, that stinks," you know. So then my grandfather would start talking to me in Japanese and Chinese, you know, because he was just so smart. He said he traveled all over the world, and I believe my grandfather, you know. But I think I had been in Al-Anon about 5 years when I realized that when my grandfather was talking to me in Japanese and Chinese, I think he was high, you know. And then later I learned that marijuana makes people lazy, so he probably never went anywhere, you know. So anyways, but he still was a very loving person. So when I started dating, I didn't want to do anything with alcoholics, but if they were addicts, of course I will date them, you know, because I thought addicts were higher class than the alcoholic. I also had never been drunk or high in my life, so I don't know the feeling. I just, you know, it's what I observe as a child. So anyways, one time my dad came to my mom and said, "You know, I'm dating this other woman, and she's much younger than you, and you know that I don't love you, so you need to leave and take your 5 kids with you." And not knowing what to do, my mom started looking for work, and but again, she was on her. She had a sixth grade education, with 5 little kids, on her middle or late 20s. So she asked me if I will take care of the kids while she came to live in the U.S. and find a job, because somebody had told her about becoming a nanny and a housemaid, and so. Anyway, so I agreed to take care of my kids, my sisters, and that's when they became my kids. And I was not a very good mother. My mom came to work in the U.S. illegally, and she started sending money so we could now eat a little better. And you know what happens? Alcoholism is a progressive disease. And my dad's alcoholism progressed, and he started looking at us like a father should never look at their kids. And today I understand it's part of the disease. And he started touching my sisters in a way a father should never touch his kids. And he started spying on me when I was getting undressed. And I got really scared, and I wrote to my mom. And I said, "Mom, this is what's going on." And she said, "I know." Because my mom had witnessed before, and she said, you can come and live with me, but you can't go to school. And I said, Mom, I'm not learning anything anyways. So I came to the U.S. like most Mexicans do. I jumped the fence and came to work illegally. I went to work at a chicken farm. And in this chicken farm, there was a lot of chickens. Of course, it was it was rows and rows and rows of chickens. And every row, there was a lot of wire boxes, okay? And on those wire boxes, there was the poop, went under the wire boxes. And there was about 20 chickens in each wire box. So my job was to give them shots so they will not get sick and they will have babies or have eggs, I'm sorry. So every time immigration came to take the illegal Mexicans back to the U.S., back to Mexico, some of us, will run up the hill to hide somewhere, and some of us will hide in the chicken poop, and I was one of those who hid in the chicken poop. And I remember sitting in the chicken poop being really, really quiet, just hoping nobody will arrest me, so I will not go back to the monster that was my dad. And when you're sitting in the chicken poop, there's worms and there's bugs, and they just stick to your skin like that. I had a lot of acne, and the chicken poop is creamy, so it really sticks to your skin. And so I remember sitting there, and when I didn't hear any noise, I will come out and try to clean myself off, but like I said, the chicken poop is creamy. So I just, I was 15 years old, and I just felt like the reject of the universe. My self-esteem was so low, and my dad also said that, every time a child was born, he would say that, another prostitute, So I grew up thinking that I was this tall, skinny, dark prostitute that should be selling food on the streets. I also tried to play with the kids in the neighborhood, and they would say, well, we don't want to play with you. You look like a dog. And I remember looking at the mirror and barking at myself and calling myself all these names. And, the alcoholic, I learned in Al-Anon that the alcoholic is only saying or reflecting of the way they feel. And it is insanity, it is insane for me to believe what a drunk person is saying. But I had to learn that, and I didn't know that at that time. And I was so cruel to myself, and I will bark at myself in the mirror and say, you're a dog, you're all this. And at this time, my dad, I was living in the U.S., my dad was no longer around, and I was still calling myself names. And that's how we become sick. And we become sick, too, by living with alcoholics. So, anyways, one day I asked my mom if I could go to school because I had no friends and I didn't speak the language. And my mom said, well, you can go to school, but you can't stop working. And I said, sure, Mom. So I went to school, and that's where I saw the most gorgeous guy of the universe. There he was. He was tall, thin, long, beautiful hair. And I just saw him, and I felt in love with him. There was just nobody else. And then I looked at me, and the tapes, you're stupid, you're a prostitute, you're ABC, whatever they told me, I believed it. My dad told me I believed it. And so I said, he'll never look at me. But in Al-Anon, also in our Courage to Change book, it says that anything we let go has our claw marks on it. So I was not going to let him go that easily, even though, I felt really bad about myself. So this guy had a lot of friends, and every time he went by, he traveled with a group of friends. A group of friends always follow him. And by this time, I had one friend. And every time this friend and I saw him walking, I will hide by the bathroom. So I started stalking him, And I will hide by the bathrooms and throw kisses at him. And then I would push my friend so he would think it was my friend. And but he realized it was me. And one day I was at the park with this friend, and there he was with his friends, and my heart started pounding so hard, and I just kept walking, you know, with nobody. And he called me over. He knew I existed. He called me over, and he's, after we introduced ourselves, he said, "Would you like to go to a concert tonight?" And I thought, "Oh my gosh, I wonder what that is." And I said, "Yes." It was 1975, and Bad Company was playing in San Diego. So he came to pick me up. I got to sit next to him. He had this little Nova. And because he had a lot of friends, I looked in the back seat, and there was, you know, people piled up on top of each other. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I wonder how they fit back there." But I didn't care. I was just sitting next to this guy who I just was so in love with. And so he pulled out an 8-track player, you know. For those young people, like, I'm going to explain, like, Matthew is a box with the phone booth. Well, it's a big tape, okay? So anyways, he put this 8-track player, put on the stereo, and this loud music came out. And then I was just so impressed. I had never listened to English music. And so people started smoking marijuana, right? And it went in front of me, and I said, "Oh, no, thank you," because I don't smoke, right? But in my head, I thought, "I can roll them for you if you need help." Because, you know, I had years of experience by that time. And so, anyways, we dated for 2 years, went to a lot of concerts. This guy, I learned that he was abandoned in Mexico by his mother when he was a little boy. He, you know, he was just a homeless kid, and now he was living here. And so I felt the necessity to protect him and give him all the love that he needed. And so when he tried to kill me a couple of times because he was high on acid, I thought, "Oh, he just needs a little more love, you know, so I just love him more." And then I thought, you know, when we get married, we're going to, you know, live in a nice area in Rancho Bernardo, which is high-class neighborhood in San Diego. And then we're going to play tennis in the weekends. And then we're going to have two lowriders park outside. Yeah. That was my way of thinking. And I really thought that. I don't know how I got that, but anyways, that was my way of thinking. But I got pregnant. And I told him, "You know, I am a strong woman, and I'm going to be okay. You don't need to marry me." And he said, "You're crazy. We're getting married." So in 1977, we got married, and as I'm walking down the aisle, I'm thinking, "Am I really a prostitute?" You know, because that's what my dad told me. And so, anyways, got married, and we had this beautiful child. And I just, you know, remember looking at my daughter, and she was just so beautiful. I was just so in love with this kid because she was a part of him and I, you know, a love, the fruit of a love that we just loved each other so much, and there she was. And so we named her Mirabella, which means look at the beauty. And we were just so in love with her. But, you know, again, my husband's alcoholism progressed, and so did mine. Soon, by this time, my sisters were not leaving the U.S. They were drinking. Some of them were using drugs. Some of them had joined dangerous gangs. Some of them were getting beat by their husbands. And life just got really bad. I started taking my daughter to my sister so they could take care of her while I worked. My husband was always in jail. I will always bail him out of jail. I will call when I couldn't find him. I remember waiting for him, you know, waiting for him by the door, waiting for him with something sexy on. And then when he didn't come home by 2, 3, 4 in the morning, I would go to the kitchen door, grab a knife, and just wait for him, you know. Just wait for him. And when I saw him coming into to the house, I would just try to kill him. You know, I just wanted to kill him. And we always lived in neighborhoods where there was a lot of gang members, a lot of drug addiction, a lot of alcoholism, and that's where we lived. And so the friends would come upstairs and try to help him. And I would tell these friends, while I had a knife in my hand, I would say, if you don't leave, I'm going to kill you too. And then the friends will go, well, we like him, but we're not that good of a friend, you know, so they would just leave. You know, I was just crazy. And so I tried, you know, cooking for him, not cooking for him, beat him up, not beat him up, sex, no sex, everything, nothing worked. Then he started shoplifting because by this time now he was using heroin. And so I started shoplifting with him because after all, he needed a supportive wife, you know. That didn't work. By this time now, I decided, okay, I'm going to have another kid. And this time, I'm going to have a boy. He's going to stop drinking. And so I had a boy. I made the promise that I had made the promise to my daughter that I was going to love and care for her and him, and nobody was ever going to hurt him because, you know, I love my kids. I just love my kids. But see, again, I didn't know how sick that I had become. So all my concentration was on what the alcoholic was doing or not doing and how to prevent him from doing whatever he was about to do. By this time, my husband was associating with the Mexican mafia. When my husband was in prison or jail, those people will come to our house and said, if you say anything that you're seeing, that you have witnessed, your family, you and your family will never see the light of day again. And I would thought, oh, they're just kidding. You know, I just never pay attention. And so, anyways, one day the judge told my husband, you either go to prison or you go to treatment. And my husband said, well, I'll go to treatment. And that's when I was introduced to Al-Anon. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I remember sitting there and thinking that I was better than, you know, and that I didn't belong there. And, you know, these really nice ladies, they share about their lives, and then they asked me if I wanted to share, and I said, well, I don't think I belong here, because, see, my husband's not an alcoholic, he's a drug addict. And again, I had the false pride that I thought addicts were higher class than the alcoholics, and I had the false pride that I was better. I'm married to this hard dude. My sisters have nice low riders. They're gang members. It's like nothing. I had nothing. And so after my husband got out of treatment, life got worse. Now my husband and my grandfather are getting high together. My kids are coming home with cigarette burns on their arms, and I just don't know what's going on. I keep finding these burned spoons, and it's like, oh, I think I must have burned that spoon. It's like, you know, the insanity. In Al-Anon, we have a pamphlet that says, are you questioning your sanity? I was questioning. I was thinking that I was doing things that I was not. So, anyways, I asked, after my husband got out of treatment, he started drinking again, and I came up with a wonderful idea. I'm still illegal at this time. Every once in a while, I get deported, and I'm sitting by the border. I'm standing by the border, making sure that there's no border patrol officers to see me so I can go across, right? And I'm standing in the border and seeing that there's nobody around, so I start running, and I run, and once I'm safe on the other side, I get disappointed that I didn't get arrested because I'm addicted to excitement. I love excitement. So I go back, and I do it again, you know. And when I don't get arrested, I go, oh, it's time I just need to go home, you know, these guys are not going to arrest me. So anyways, I tell my husband, at this time I had learned a little bit of English where I could cross the border. And I told my husband, I know what the problem is. It's your friends. We just need to move away from this area. So we moved to Tijuana. And now we're living in Tijuana. And he, of course, finds new connections. And I'm there along with my kids. And so nothing was working. So I decided to take karate classes because he needed a stronger message. So I went into karate classes. And then when he would come home, I remember pretending that I was asleep. And as soon as he would walk into the bedroom, I would jump out of bed and go, ha, ha, try to cut him in little pieces. And that didn't work. He continued to drink. One day, I would drive 140 miles a day, something like that, to keep my husband away from his friends. And I had this little car. And I remember one day looking on the right side, and I saw my husband passed out. I know in AA they call it a moment of clarity. For me, it was waking up of a nightmare. And I remember looking at my husband, and I no longer care what happened to him. And I looked in the back seat of the car, and there was two kids. And those kids were just sitting there like zombies. Those kids had no joy on their face. Their eyes were dropped down. They had the saddest look on their eyes. Their hair was long, and they just sat there like zombies. And then I remember saying, what happened here? How did I get here? What happened to the promise that I made to those kids that I was going to love and care for them? I was hitting my kids because every time my husband and I will fight, you know, the kids will come out running out of the rooms and say, Mom, stop. You know, those kids love their father. They just didn't know what was wrong with me. They knew their father was drinking, you know, but they didn't know what was wrong with me. And they would say, Mom, stop. Leave him alone. And so I remember grabbing my kids and throwing them in the room, closing the door while they were screaming. They were scared. And so I remember in that moment, it was like an old movie went by, and I said, I made a promise to care for those kids, and I'm not. The upholstery of the car had been teared down. These kids were super skinny. I became vegetarian when I was 11 years old, so by this time my kids were born vegetarian, and there was no food for them to eat. There's no milk in Mexico. There's no running water. There's no grass. There's nothing, and my husband did not take him there. I took him there, and on that date, I remember going to my first Al-Anon meeting because I had run out of ideas, and then I said, what do I do now? What can I do? And I remember remembering the Al-Anon meeting, and I remember the sparkle on people's eyes, and the only two things that stayed in my head on the first meeting is keep coming back and first things first. And on that day, my kids were first. So that day, I made a decision to move back to the States. We rented an apartment, and my husband and I went to prison. And on that day, you know, before that, I had tried everything, you know, to help the alcoholic, but I had never paid attention on me. I remember thinking, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And I remember when I was a little girl going to church and telling the priest, well, my dad beat me, so I beat my sisters. And the priest will say, well, get on your knees and pray. I knew that didn't work for me because I just felt worse leaving the church than when I got there. Then thinking, maybe I need to go to a psychologist. Maybe I need to go to a counselor. I just need help. I know I'm not okay. I knew that I was not okay. I just could not change. And I remember thinking, no, people like me don't go to counselors. People that go to counselors have boogers coming out of their nose and saliva. And there was a lot of things wrong with me, but there were no liquids coming out of my face, you know. So I didn't belong there. And one day I put my two kids in the back seat of the car, and I started driving it because there was no way out. There was nowhere for me to go, nothing. nothing. And I started driving, and I remember driving 100 miles, in the freeway, and saying, if there's somebody up there, please help me stop, because I just want to die. I knew that if my kids were to survive that lifestyle, they will either go to jail, end up in prison, or die. I just become gang members, heroin addicts, because that's people were dropping dead at that time. And so I just, I knew that I love my kids so much, and I didn't want them to die there because there was nothing else. So anyways, I said, if there's somebody up there, please help me stop because I just want to die. And when we ask God for help, God always listens. It might take him a little bit of time. In God's time, everything's very short, but in our humanness, everything takes long. Okay, so soon after that, that's when my husband went to the judge and they sent him to treatment. So I knew that Al-Anon, that God had given me a second chance. And when I went to my second meeting, I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And I was ready to do anything the program told me because I knew that my way of thinking was not right. So I went to the meeting, and I remember there was no Spanish meetings. I didn't speak the language, but I understood. And I paid a lot of attention. And I remember sitting there shaking. I had this big jacket on, holes on my jeans. My hair was long, and it covered my face. My husband used to cut my hair when he was drunk because we needed to save money. So he would cut my hair. I couldn't go to the hairdresser. So I remember sitting there shaking. And the first miracle happened. It was a large meeting in a small room, and two people sat next to me, and their shoulders touched my shoulders. And when we have cold, there's loneliness, there's just fear, there's everything in there, and not a blanket big enough can cover that pain or give you, some sort of serenity. But in that meeting, I stopped shaking for the first time in a long time. I was super thin. I had lost a lot of weight. And I heard, get a sponsor, work the steps, stay connected, read the literature, and do service. So I thought I needed to do everything they told me to do, so I did. I kept going to meetings. On my third meeting, I asked this man to be my sponsor. His name is Ralph. And I went up to Ralph after the meeting, and I said, will you be my sponsor? And I asked Ralph to be my sponsor because every time somebody shared, Ralph will acknowledge the person. And when we live in alcoholic homes, our literature talks about that we speak a different language. And we do. I remember screaming at my husband. He was screaming me back at me, and we just could not understand what we were saying. And so Al-Anon, he was, sorry. Oh, can't hear me? Sorry. Okay. So I learned that I needed to get a sponsor, and Ralph will acknowledge people when they were speaking. So every time, so after the meeting, I went up to Ralph and I said, will you be my sponsor? And see, I didn't know Ralph was from England, and Ralph has a strong English accent. And I'm from Mexico. I can't speak the language. I'm just trying to make it across. Sponsor? Me? And Ralph looked at me, and he said, we'll give it a try, But see, Ralph has the unconditional love that we so much talk about in our meetings. He didn't care how I looked, or whether I spoke the language or not. Ralph was willing to help another person when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon always be there. And Ralph was there for me. So Ralph and I started getting together 3 times a week because I needed a lot of help. And I learned, you know, we started going through the first step, and Ralph would say, you know, can you explain it better? Because I couldn't write English, and Ralph, you know, so I will try to explain, and I learned that I couldn't change anybody. You know, and my life had become unmanageable. I already knew that, you know. Then I went to step 2 and step 3, and when we got to step 4, I was so happy he never flunked me because I stayed back in third grade 3 times, you know. I learned that I could no longer take my kids to my sisters because, like I mentioned earlier, they were coming home with cigarette burns on their skin. And so I learned that I couldn't trust the alcoholic with my little ones. So my little ones will come to the park where Ralph and I met, and they will play while Ralph and I will, you know, do our step study. I remember, you know, on my first step telling Ralph, you know, my dad says I'm stupid, you know, I would just go through my list, and Ralph said, Magdalena, stop. You cannot call yourself bad names. He said, the alcoholic's perception is different. The person is sick, and you need to understand that. So he said, you cannot call yourself names. And so I stopped calling myself names, and I started walking straighter, looking at people in the eye. I became a part of you. I was no longer a side of. I became a part of you. I was no longer less or more. I was equal. And I became the coffee person. They gave me the great honor to be the coffee person because I heard service, right? We got to get into service. So I remember they would give me two pots of coffee, empty pots of coffee, and I would go next room where they had where the alcoholics were, you know. And that guy was so nice. I would give him 2 empty pots and he would give me 2 full pots of coffee back, and then he said, dear, if you need more, come back. And I was like, oh, that's how I was introduced to sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just thought they were so nice. And I got into service right away above the group level. I started meetings because I knew, okay, that's the problem. My family needs Al-Anon. That's all. We're going to be all cured. We're all going to be happy. Everybody's going to stop drinking. And so I opened an Al-Anon meeting in Spanish, and none of them came. But other people came. You know, I was so busy. I learned how to, you know, take care of my kids. I asked my friends, I told them, I don't know what to do with these kids. They're just screaming. I don't know what to do with them. I want to hit them. And my friends say, well, Magdalena, what you do, my sponsor told me this. He's like, you listen to the kids. The kids have something to say. It is important for you to listen to the kids. If they're crying, they're crying for a reason. So they told me, after you pick up the kids from the daycare, you take them home, you feed them, you help them with their homework, you go for a walk with them, and don't say anything, just listen. And my kids started talking. They started telling me, you know, their dreams about their friends. They had little brains. They were just so beautiful. And then they said, and when you get home, give him a bath, put him in bed, and read a story. And then you go to bed, and you read something. In the Al-Anon, on the Just for Today pamphlet, it says that just for today, I will not be a mental loafer. I will study and read something useful. So my husband got out of prison. He came home. And I already had a life. I had no time for him. And one day, you know, he came home and I was reading. And then he said, well, if you don't do A, B, and C, I'm going to go out and get drunk. And I said, well, just make sure you lock the door on the way out, you know. So I had learned to detach with love. You know, I no longer needed to beat him up. And so instead of going out to get drunk, he went to an AA meeting, and today he's been sober for 32 years, you know. It was 1990, and the international convention was happening in Seattle. By the way, I also learned in Al-Anon that if Al-Anon is helping me, why wouldn't it help my kids? So I took them to an Al-Anon meeting, and they got so involved in service. They were so happy. Kids had a place to go to. They were doing really good. And every time I would tell my kids, because now we're a family in recovery, I want to hear from my kids. And I would tell my kids, if I'm screaming, please let me know, because I don't know that my voice is getting high. I've just been talking like this for a long time. And my kids will say, they had no problem telling me what I was doing wrong and what tradition I was violating or anything. And they say, Mom, you're screaming. I go, okay, thank you. You know. So it was 1990, and my husband and I came to the convention. We brought the kids, and everybody was so happy. And after that convention, we just fell in love with Seattle. I had never seen so many rivers, so many green trees. Everything was so beautiful, just like it is here. And I told my husband, why don't we move? And he said, well, there's nothing stopping us. By this time, you know what happens when we stop bailing the alcoholic out of jail? There's money. So we were able to buy a home, a trailer, everything, a boat, everything that we wanted, we were able to get. So we sold everything and moved to Seattle, and I went to work at and moved into one-bedroom apartment. The kids were happy. They thought they were camping every night because it's so green. And I went to the local, I became a waitress at a Denny's restaurant. And my husband used to make elevators, and now he was cleaning the elevators at the airport. But, you know, we didn't care because we had you. When we have a family that fills our hearts, we're okay. So I went to the local intergroup office, and I said, do you have any service positions for me? Because I know I can't keep it unless I give it away. I need to be busy. And this really nice lady, they said, well, just keep coming back. And so they granted me the grand opportunity of being the Al-Anon coordinator for the Seattle Intergroup office. I had already been the Al-Anon coordinator for the San Diego office, so it was, you know, I had some experience. And my daughter got involved again in Al-Anon. Husband started some Spanish meetings. I was just busy. And one day I remember getting up from work and on my green uniform, full of grease, and I used to get off from work at 6 in the morning, and I will come home, and that day I remember getting on my knees and thinking, God, how much longer do I need to be doing these kind of jobs? I had already talked to my sponsor about that, and my sponsor said, Magdalena, you need to be educated. You can't do anything in life, you know, about what you have been doing. You can be educated. And I told Ralph, I can learn. Remember, I'm stupid. I stayed back in third grade 3 times. And Ralph said, no, you do not call yourself names. And by this time, you know, I have always loved exercising, so I remember running. And I used to call myself names every time somebody passed me. I would say, oh, you're so slow. Oh, you're so stupid. You just give me bad names. But my sponsor said I couldn't call myself names. So every time I would go for a run, and every time somebody passed me, I would think to myself, pretty woman running down the street. And so I started feeling so good that I'm running marathons now, and I'm just having so much fun. But anyways, I told my sponsor that I couldn't get educated, but my sponsor believed I could. So on that date, I made a resume of my jobs, like housekeeper, nanny, waitress, factory worker, whatever. There's nothing wrong with those jobs, but ours is a program of progress, not perfection. And I needed to trust that I could do something different. And so that day I made a decision to go to school. And in 1999, I graduated with a four-year college degree, because my sponsor told me. Thank you. During this time, I saw that my daughter was so, although she was so involved in Alatin, she looked like she was, her health was declining. And she was coming home with bruises in her arm. She had become super skinny. And I just couldn't understand, because she was very active in Alatin. And one day I realized that she was drinking. And we offered her help, and my daughter said, well, sure, I'll go to treatment. So she went to treatment. She came out. She will drink again. And she would do this over and over again. And one day, you know, and I remember driving somewhere and screaming at the God of my understanding. I said, why would you give me an alcoholic daughter after all the service work I have done? You know? So I called my sponsor and I said, Magdalena, God loves alcoholics too. And he wants your daughter to learn something. And so I thought it was all about me. You know, it's God only loves me, but no, God loves everybody. And so my daughter will come home and tell my son, if you don't drink with me, you're not a man. So she was violating that unity of the home. And we had to ask her to move out. She was around 15, 16 years old. And so my husband and I started fighting. We were in so much pain that the disease was affecting the unity of our home. So when somebody is affecting the unity of our home, they need to leave, just like we do that sometimes in groups. One day my daughter came home and she said, Mom, I want to go to treatment. And I said, no, don't go to treatment. You go to AA, because I trust my kids with AA. I know AA saves lives. And I said, you go to AA, get a sponsor, work the steps, and you're going to be okay. And she said, she looked at me and she got really close and she said, Mom, don't you understand? I can't stop drinking. And when she got close to me, she smelled just like my dad, the stale alcohol that I couldn't stand on my dad. Now it was in my daughter. And I said, no, I don't. And so my husband and I grabbed her again, put her in a blanket, and we took her to treatment in Spokane on a Thanksgiving weekend. It was a snowy day. And so we took her to treatment. At the treatment center, they took her to a Native American meeting. At the Native American meeting, they needed a coffee person, and she became a coffee person. And today, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, she's been sober for 22 years. And I'm just so grateful. My son, that he said 10 years of Alatin is good enough, Mom. I'm cured. I'm well now. I'm normal. He's drinking right now, but again, he's in the hands of God, because God loves our children so much that in Al-Anon we learn to give them to God. It's like, here, God, take my kids. They're all yours. Because before they were my kids, they were God's kids. And they are still God's kids. So he's in the hands of God. And I know he knows where the help is. When he was 15 years old, he had a girlfriend. He was in high school. This kid does everything right. And he broke up with the girlfriend and him. I'm sorry, go back. He had a girlfriend. They got a cat together. When they broke up, my son gained custody of the cat and brought the cat home. I hate cats, okay? So one day, I was not working at my Al-Anon program as I should, because I was spying on him. You know, I was looking in his room. My son never misses school. He works after school. He does everything right. He participates in activities. But this day he was busy and he didn't clean his room. And I opened the door and I saw that he had a big mess. Tradition 10 talks about it, but not getting into outside issues. His room is an outside issue. You know, I was looking for controversy. So I was just looking for controversy and I look at the room and I wrote him a nasty note. I said, if you don't clean your room, I'm going to throw your cat away. And then my son wrote me another nasty note back saying, Mom, I'm cleaning my room one day at a time. So I'm not all the way done yet. There he had the audacity to put the triangle with the circle. He put A.A. Allen on. Keep coming back. It works. Then in Spanish, P.S., leave my cat alone. So when he went away to the university, I got stuck taking care of the cat, you know. But I introduced him to the outside world, you know, and now he's a happy, joyous, and free cat. Yeah. He graduated, and now he's got a wonderful job. He loves life. Every Wednesday, we have a family dinner, every Wednesday. And if I'm not home for reasons of service, he has a little problem with that. He loves his parents. Both of our kids just love our, they just love us. My daughter got married to the guy of her dreams. Unfortunately, they had a beautiful daughter. Unfortunately, her husband relapsed and they separated. And she told him, you know, I love you so much, but I love my daughter and my sobriety more. And she walked out of the marriage just like that. She never had to bail him out of jail. She didn't have to take karate classes. Nothing. She just walked out like that. She's remarried and has two more kids, and she's a happy kid. You know, she just loves her parents. And so today, Carlos and I have been married for 38 years. I have... Today I work as a parole officer. I send people to treatment all the time. If they don't want to go, I'm sorry, I send people to AA and treatment all of the time. If they have problems with going to AA, I have no problems placing them in jail, you know. Many people die in the process, and we know how this disease is. I called Ralph one time. My job can be dangerous, and we do this all the time. You know, once a week, we serve warrants, and we go into people's homes, into alcoholics' homes, and they have weapons, they have drugs, they have, you know, Matthew described it last night really good. The rooms are dark, covered with God knows how many blankets. And so we go into these rooms, and we take those people out, take their weapons and their alcohol and their drugs and everything. Alcoholics don't like that, you know. So I called Ralph and I said, you know, Ralph, my job is dangerous. I think I need to be armed. And so I said, but I don't know if I, in order to be armed, I need to pass this psychological evaluation. And I don't know if I can pass it because, you know, I'm kind of crazy. And Ralph said, well, if God wants you to have a gun, you will. So today I'm an armed officer. I call my sisters and I say, guess what? I have a gun. And they're like, is your husband going to be okay? They don't understand recovery. But, yeah. As Janet mentioned earlier, I have been in service of the general service for 18 years. I started as a group rep, then district rep. I just became delegate. I became the chairperson, and for 18 years, I have been very busy and speaking every once in a while and meeting all of you wonderful people. But now, you know, my service has ended, and it's rotation of leadership. And so I'm beginning to see that my relationship with my husband needs to be worked on. And I see that he comes home like at 1 in the morning after meeting with his sponsees, and I'm beginning to have a problem with that. And again, it's none of my business. But so he is very happy that I'm here today with all of you, and I'm not letting him, I'm not checking his time. You know, The great thing about Al-Anon is that we keep working on ourselves one day at a time, and there's never enough growth. There's always room for growth. I am so grateful for the life that I have today. And I got to tell you, because I always forget, I did become legal because my sponsor told me to. He said, you need to become legal, Magdalena. This is an honest program. So today I am a U.S. citizen, and I am grateful for everything I have because of you. God bless you and keep coming back. Thank you.